Match of my life. Life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.
Today's Match of My Life guest has made a real impression on the city, whether it be through arts, culture, sports, radio. He's the man who founded our radio station so many years ago. And look at it now, Terry Smith. Morning to you, Terry.
Good morning to you.
Goodness
nice
me.
To be here.
There's so many things I don't know about your life story, so I thought you were just a brilliant guest to have on. We've had footballers, managers, all sorts in here, but I think you played such an influential role in how this city has changed. You probably wouldn't admit it yourself because you're a fairly modest man. But having been around here for so many decades and seen the changing face of Liverpool, you're a proud Scouser, aren't you?
And an honorary one, of course. I'm from Yorkshire originally, but most of my life has been here in Liverpool, certainly more than 50 years now.
Where were you born?
In Dewsbury in Yorkshire, a little town near Leeds.
And what brought you over to Merseyside then?
Well, I was a journalist and I did the usual traditional thing, local papers, evening papers, working for, at the end of that, Granada TV, the Sunday Express. But then I very much wanted to start my own agency, the News and Picture Agency, where we employed reporters and photographers and sold stories and pictures and features to whoever would buy them. And Liverpool seemed to be the obvious place to do it.
There was always a story here.
Well, it was just taking off. Everything was happening. It was the early 60s. And the early 60s were the early 60s when, you know, were a very important part of people's lives. Things were changing. Young people were coming out and doing things. And, of course, we had the music era, plus a great sporting city as well. And it was obvious if you're looking for things to sell, news and pictures, Liverpool seemed to me to be the place to find them. And it was.
You had your head switched on. Were you a Liverpool fan at that stage?
Yes. We started doing match reports, Liverpool match reports, and Everton for provincial newspapers and Scottish and Irish Sunday papers and things like that. They were regular clients. But then I just grew closer to the club and started getting involved in a few things with them and helping them out with a few things. And yes, absolutely.
We'll talk about your involvement with Liverpool Football Club in a bit more depth later. Talk about this press agency which sort of blossomed here. So Mercury Press, and you were very much at the helm of things there?
Yeah, Mercury Press was. I kept it and ran it for many years, right up to the start of Radio City, really, because I was in the group, of course, that started it. And I suppose the real idea was that we were hoping to find yet another market for news and pictures, and Radio City was going to be it. Another good deal for Mercury Press, except it went wrong because in giving us the licence, the authorities declined to let me continue running Radio City and Mercury Press.
Together? You weren't allowed to do the two of them?
I wasn't allowed to do the two of them, so obviously Mercury Press had to go because City was such an exciting thing to do. And that passed on to Roger Blyth, who was one of our broadcasters. But it was all right to have the broadcaster on it, but not the owner of the station.
And that's still a little bit of a bitter mark for you. How important was it to you at the time to get a radio licence? And, looking back, it was quite a pioneering move you made there.
It was an amazing time, really. I'd been involved, or the agency had been involved, with the BBC local station when it started. We provided journalists to do shifts and morning news and most of their sports programmes. And it was the bug. They had an incredible manager who got everyone very excited about local radio. And it certainly stuck with me. And then the opportunity came to introduce commercial radio around the UK. And that seemed to me to be a great thing to do. So I put the group together. There were 8 groups after the licence, but we won it and have had it ever since.
How warmly was it welcomed in Liverpool and Merseyside when you first went on air? Was it something of a special occasion? Did it take some time before people bought into this idea of commercial radio?
It took a little time, but it was a very different kind of station. We were one of the very first few, first 6, and we had a very big newsroom. We had 18 journalists on staff when we started, so a very big news operation and sports operation. But we were very controversial, deliberately. and really tested the edges of what was allowed and what wasn't.
Because you thought that would get people listening and get people to stay with
you. By that time, I knew Liverpool. a bit of controversy is what they love and want. But we knew that we'd make mistakes, which we certainly did, and many, many of them. But I always had in mind that Liverpool will stay with us, provided we do some of the things that we said we were going to do, new programme ideas, new ways of doing things, and getting involved. And when we're wrong, we say we're wrong. But, you know, they'll forgive that so long as you're really doing the right things. The right things by them are not necessarily the right things by the rest of the world. But we did them anyway.
Did you choose the first lineup? Were you the man responsible for the first set of presenters? Many people out there will remember the initial Radio City presenters.
Every single one. Yeah. We employed about 50 odd people to start with, maybe 60. Yeah. And I personally, I didn't appoint everyone. The news editor obviously appointed journalists. But I saw and talked to every single one before they joined the staff. It was that important.
What was it you wanted to create? If you had you must have had a radio station in your mind. It wasn't just about music; it was about reflecting the personality of the city and the wider community. What did you want coming out of the speakers in the '70s? Because was it 74? Four, yeah.
6 a.m. October 21st, 1974.
there forever.
I put that on my tombstone. But we were going to be different. We were going to be controversial. We were going to tell it as it was. We were going to break monopolies like live coverage of sport, for example, which was really owned by the BBC, and many, many battles, and nearly finished up in the High Court on that one. But to really have local people, not people that would talk about Gaytaker and things like that, people who understood the locality, new to journalism. But we got very lucky. I mean, the number of staff that were with us in the early days who now have top broadcasting jobs around the world, really, but especially in London on ITV and BBC, was legion. It became very quickly a good place to have worked. And people who started their careers here, many, many, many of them, and we still meet up once in a while, remember it with great affection. I certainly do. And I was doing there for 35 years.
Let's talk about that sporting journey within radio. You mentioned how tough it was to actually just get a foothold on the radio covering sport. Why was that?
A lot of it was defensiveness. In fact, all of it was defensiveness by the BBC. They assumed that they owned sports coverage, live sports coverage.
As in football commentary?
On radio, football commentary in particular, because that was always the big one. And they were very good at it, and everybody accepted it, and they had very good people working for them and good coverage. Well, of course, you really had to have a validity in Liverpool. You had to have a very good coverage of Liverpool and Everton. And I'm sure the same was in Manchester, but they didn't have the determination that we had to break the BBC monopoly. And
that made you a little bit more focused, determined to get in there.
Yes, a bit more pragmatic and practicing the dark arts a bit more. But it took 2 years, but we really had to fight all the way. Mm. And even when we'd broken the monopoly, the problem still went on. I remember in the early days, very early days, probably about 76, Radio City, but by that time, we had limited budgets, of course, but we did invest in two or three of the boards round Anfield and Goodison. And that was fine. We were quite pleased with them. And we got them for a couple of seasons. But when Match of the Day was at either ground being filmed, because they didn't do the number of games then that they do now, the producers started pressurising the club to cover our boards up, which is...
The boards being the advertising signs around the pitch, yeah.
I mean, incredibly trivial and petty, but that's what they did. Yeah. And that was their feeling at the time. We got it stopped. I wrote personally to Ian Trethewan, who was then Director General of the BBC, and he was horrified when he realised what some idiot producer had been up to. Apologised straight away and it stopped dead, and that was the end of the matter. But it illustrates the atmosphere that we started in, and it was quite difficult, but we got there.
It probably made you more determined to produce a better product. And, of course, as you mentioned there, through several decades, sport or football commentary and this station have been intrinsically interlinked, haven't they, because of the quality of what was produced.
Yes, we were very lucky in again getting the right people. I mean, our first sports commentator was Elton Welsby, who went on for years on Granada. The second one was the best of the whole bunch. That was Clive Tyldesley. Clive was with us for 10 years, amazingly. And it was pretty obvious that he was far and away the best in the business, whether you were talking about BBC, commercial radio, or all the rest of it. And indeed, it was proven when he went to the television, because for the next 4 years, he was elected as the best television sports commentator on either network. So, but Clive was very, very good. And his number two was Richard Keys, who got involved in all kinds of things, including football.
But radio, of course, and football commentary, it was a different. There was a different reliance by supporters who couldn't get to the game. So these days, everything is quite easily accessed, whether it be through a hooky feed on your phone or your computer. Yeah. If you go back to the 70s and the 80s, there was a devotion, a dedication to actually the output, because it was probably the only way people could be there if they weren't at the game.
Yes, that's true. I mean, the difference now, of course, is that the scores are live every second virtually of every game on radio, on television, on web, anything you can think of, and all the rest of it. But we did it quite differently. We had no nonsense about equality or editorial fairness or anything like that. I mean, if Liverpool never were winning, it was good news. If they were losing, it was bad news, and the referee was probably to blame. We didn't have any idea of fairness or anything else. We were utterly biased in favour of local teams, just like the people listening to us.
You brought big names to the airways. We had John Toshack in recently, and he fondly remembered McIntosh.
I think everybody does.
Yeah. You had Bill Shankly presenting a show on the radio station as well. How did that happen? How did you get Bill Shankly to be part of Radio City?
Well, I'd got quite friendly with Bill over the years, and he was very generous in his time with my kids. And we wanted to do something. We were always looking for things to do different. And it was actually coming up to... Bill had retired. He retired just about 3 weeks before Radio City started, which was bad timing by him and us. And we obviously missed out on perhaps the biggest sporting story in many, many years in Liverpool, because we weren't broadcasting. But nevertheless, Bill was very, very good with us. We had the usual rows with him, as every journalist did, but they were forgotten 10 minutes later. And... we had this idea that we got Bill, I suppose, when we had the first European Cup final, after he'd gone, Bob Paisley's first, and it had become quite difficult up at Anfield between Bob and Bill Shankly after Bill had retired. Because Bill was a natural showman. He thought in quotes. He had lovely stories, and it was very impressive. When we used to go to London with the team, even journalists from national newspapers that weren't covering the game used to turn up at Euston to get something out of Bill, and he always delivered. But when Bob Paisley took over, Bill stayed away for a few weeks, or a few months actually, and it became obvious that things were not right between them. And we soon discovered what the reason was. The people were still going, when Bill was going to the games, the journalists from national newspapers, and especially the Monday papers, had to find something different to what had already appeared in the Sunday papers. They were going to Bill for quotes rather than Bob. Now, Bob was never easy with journalists or quotes. It was extremely difficult for him, and he got more and more frustrated.
You saw an opportunity to.
He did. I mean, Bill wasn't being in any way malicious. He was just being Bill. And he'd been talking to these journalists for donkey's years. And he just carried on. But it got more and more upsetting to Bill. But I remember discussing it with Peter Robinson, the chief executive at the time. And we wanted to take. And again, it was doing something different. We wanted to take Bill to the first European Cup final. With the commentator. So he was our summariser. Once it agreed, we advertised it very widely. We thought, well, that's why everybody. We've got Bill, that's it.
Everyone will listen to us. We've got Bill Shankly, yeah.
Exactly, and that's what happened. But then things started to stick. And we had an idea one day. I still claim it was mine, although other people have been making the same claim, that getting Bill as a talk show host could be magic if he'd do it. And I asked him, and he did. And it was an amazing start to the programme because we'd got Bill lined up and quite a big promotional package around him. The programme was just called to be Shankly. That's all you needed. And it was just Bill talking to famous people. Except we think, well, which famous people? And it was quite difficult to, get the people we wanted at short notice. But we were sitting in my office, kicking it around. Bill came in for a chat. And the question always was, who are we going to get for the first show? Because this is the one that the press, everybody will be listening to. And we tried a lot of people who just weren't available, loved the idea, but weren't available. And at that time, Radio City wasn't top of many people's lists for an appearance to come up from London. But Bill said, well, he said, what about Harold Wilson? He'd be good. And everybody said, yeah, great. It just happens to be Prime Minister. That's, he said, no, yeah, but he's at Highton as well, which he was, MP for Highton. He said, why don't I ring him up and see if he'll come on? So everybody said, well, you can try a bill, but, you don't just ring the Prime Minister up. And he said, well, we'll try. And off he went. To a private office, made this phone call, came back, said, the sale will ring back. So I thought, yeah, yes, they will, but no, they won't. But then about 5 minutes later, the receptionist came in and said, there's a Mr. Wilson on the phone, wants to speak to Mr. Shankly.
The Prime Minister.
she didn't say that. She said, Mr. Wilson. And Bill said, well, can you put it through here? So, of course, we're all agog by this time, and we could only hear part of the conversation. And it was Bill saying, I've got this programme on radio, it's new, and I want somebody, famous to get it going on the first programme. And I'd love it if you'd do it, you see. Silence. And Bill said, what time do we want him? To the assembled people. And we said 10 o'clock, whatever it was, on such and such day, because it has to be live. And Bill said, he's coming, he'll be here. And he did. And they had a most amazing interview. And, of course, it made full-page pictures in every national newspaper, really got the programme and Bill off to a good start.
It's immortalised by a photo we've got here in the
everywhere,
station.
Everywhere, yeah.
And one of them, so obviously the Prime Minister's there with his pipe, and then there's a Guinness on the table, isn't there? It's the most surreal
unbelievable
thing you've probably ever seen, isn't it?
Well, it was a very big success for us, and it worked very well. And of course, Bill, he didn't do it for long. He did it for about 5 months, 6 months. But the audience figures were just unbelievable. And because it was in the early days, it really took a big step and putting the station on the map. And we became quite famous with Bill Shankly and Harold Wilson still.
Plenty more we can talk about with Terry Smith, founder of Radio City. He's our guest today on Match of My Life.
Match of My Life. Life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.
And today's Match of My Life guest is Terry Smith, the founder of Radio City, and also a man who sat on the board at Liverpool Football Club for many years. So let's get a bit of an insight into being a director at Liverpool, as well as all the other jobs he was doing. Terry, so when did this come about? When did you all of a sudden find yourself amongst the boardroom elite at Liverpool?
Well, it started, I suppose, because of the connection. We were reporting, the agency I ran was reporting their matches and Everton's matches for multiple provincial papers and Irish Sunday papers and things like that. And it started to get a bit more involved. I started to do other things with them. They asked me to do things as well, and it just grew together. I mean, I had a very clear intention of trying to get on the board. It wasn't just luck.
It didn't just happen. You always had a desire.
A desire and a clear intention of how it should be.
Allies were who? Peter Robinson?
Peter Robinson and John Smith. I helped John out a lot. I mean, he was a superb chairman, and he and Peter Robinson were a great team. I mean, that was the era for Liverpool, and between the two of them. And hopefully we're going to have another one very soon, or it's on its way now. But no, they were great. And I started to be invited more to the games and less to work. And one thing led to another. And then when Bob Paisley stopped being manager, he became a director about a year later. And after a couple of years, he was ill and declining and left the board. And I took his seat. They invited me to take his seat on the board, which I enjoyed for the next 15 years.
Yeah, what a ride. What an insight for essentially a journalist, a man with a very active mind who all of a sudden was going, crossing the border, if you like.
It was heartbreaking, really, because there were so many major stories that weren't getting out. And I was probably the only journalist in any boardroom in the Premier League club. And especially for away matches, we'd meet lots of famous people in London and all the rest of it. And it was story after story after story. But it would only wanted one of them to leak out. And I'd have been blamed for it, and no way would it ever happen. And that's also been true since. I mean, I had several approaches regarding possible books and series and things like that, but no way.
Your mouth has always been zipped. Look, you mentioned the great relationship yourself and your family had with Bill Shankly. What about Bob Paisley as a man?
Well, Bob was a total mystery. I mean, he was shy and awkward and could be quite bitter at times. And we had a number of arguments with him when he was we'd been Radio City. I remember Clive Tilsley getting banned, and a more decent, friendly guy than Clive you'll never meet. But all that happened was Bob had been accused of thumping a guy in a private family type thing. And everybody had the story. But because Radio City was here, we broadcast the story first. Probably the BBC did it about the same time, but it was Radio City that got blamed for breaking the story. Well, it was too late for the Echo, and it was picked up by regional news in the evening. But that was all later, because we were first with it. We got blamed, and Clive was told to stay away. But it passed over, and Bob was a lovely man in many ways, but he was a very, very difficult guy to deal with. Because he was shy and guarded, and he didn't really trust anyone. But a man of great charm. I remember one story about him, which hasn't been told before, I don't think. I've certainly never told it. But when Kevin Keegan left, there was a desperate need to replace him, and Kenny Dalglish became the target. And finally, there was one day, and the board all knew about it, but no one else did. Three of the club representatives, Sid Reeks, the then senior director, Peter Robinson and Bob, went up to Glasgow and signed Kenny overnight. And when they'd finished, it was quite late on. And Sid Reeks, who liked a glass or two, said, that's brilliant, great day's work, you know, we're all very pleased, we've got Kenny Dalglish, let's find somewhere to have a drink and a meal and celebrate. Bob wasn't there with that. He said, no bloody way. He said, the only sensible thing to do is to get out of town before they realise what we've done. And out of town they got, and the uproar that then happened in Glasgow by, the fans terribly upset that he was leaving, and thought the club had betrayed them by selling him. The fact was, Kenny wanted to come to Liverpool anyway, and whatever a player wants, he always finishes up getting.
Bob knew the scale of the business he'd done there. You worked as a member of the board with a variety of different managers. Hmm. Obviously, you just mentioned Bob had been on the board and you replaced him at the time. How much of an influence do you have as board members? At a club like Liverpool?
Not as much as we'd like to think.
Or the fans would think.
Or the fans probably think. You're always there to be blamed. If you're hit a bad spell, the board's at fault for doing all the wrong things. If you succeed, it's the manager and the players, and nobody even thinks about the board. I mean, Bill Shankly defined it once when he said the all that matters in a football club are the players, the managers and the fans. He said all directors do is sign cheques. And he was probably right. By and large, on big issues, obviously, you do make decisions about finances, what we can afford, what we can't afford, the appointment of a manager, the sacking of a manager, that kind of thing. But by and large, on the day-to-day places, you tend to stay away from the players and the training ground, and that suits everybody. Because, you know, there was a time when, and it happened at Liverpool and Everton, where the board used to have a weekly meeting to pick the team. Well, now you try and tell a manager that even expressing an opinion can be quite touchy. Unless you agree with something he's already said, then you're a hero. But it's always difficult, but everybody has their role. But it doesn't have terribly influence on a day-to-day basis. But the big issues, yes. What regarded by fans as big issues, less so.
Well, tell us about the appointment of Kenny Dalglish then. Obviously, Joe Fagan only in charge for one season and obviously with a great trophy haul as well. But you were obviously on the board at that time then.
Yeah.
Was it an obvious step for the football club?
It was obvious because Peter Robinson was the one that really wanted to do that. Mm. And, you know, by and large, we'd had a succession of managers following each other. The boot room had just kept on moving up.
That's it. You actually moved out of the boot room.
We moved
out
of that. Well, it was a big stage. They got back into it later with Roy Evans, of course. Mm. But it was a change. But you know, Kenny was always someone special, even among all great players. And he was canny and he understood football. And he and Steve Highway, over a slightly different period, were people who really understood football and footballers, not just liking them or disliking them or knowing them, but understanding what made them tick. And it was an idea and it worked.
So you had those wonderful years between the mid-80s to 89, 90, and then things changed slightly. And obviously Graham Souness is appointed, so fortune doesn't always favour you at a football club. And
no, I think they, I mean, I was there when there were lots of managers, probably about five, of which Graham was one. Mm. And I always felt terribly sorry for Graham. First of all, he had a very difficult domestic situation, and all I would say in that was he was treated extremely badly, but better not say more than that. Mm. But he came back to Liverpool as manager. The mistake that he first made was not bringing his own people in. But it was strange. He's a fabulous guy and has become, you know, pretty famous as a media, one of the very best. But it was very difficult for him at Liverpool because all the things that made him a great player, or many of the things that made him a great player, made him a not very good manager. Utterly ruthless, one opinion, his, and wanted to pick fights with various members of the board and anybody who could have a go at him. He's an aggressive Scot, and that's very well when you're a great footballer, which he undoubtedly was. But it rubs up people the wrong way as a manager. And he's acknowledged that himself many times since.
It didn't quite work for him. Obviously, Roy was brought in later on in the mid-90s, which was a lovely return to the boot room. And I would imagine, you know, you felt that sort of connection there.
I think we all did. Because Roy had been with the club since he was a lad. He was part of everything that had happened in the eras. He was a total member of the boot room, if you like. A thoroughly decent guy, friendly, honest, straightforward. Had a little difficulty dealing with players. He was a bit too pally with some of them, and I think he's acknowledged that since too. But it was a difficult time. We weren't particularly strong on the team at the time, and he did have a difficult time. But he did his best. And then came Mr. Hulier, of course, and there was a rather daft idea where they became joint managers.
Come on, who thought of it, Terry?
That was never going to work. I can't claim that.
That didn't come from you then?
No, and I'm not going to say who it did come from.
Did you oppose it?
No, I didn't.
No.
It we just felt that we had to do it. It was, yeah. It was, I mean, at the end of the day, the whole board agreed to do it. It wasn't an easy decision, and it wasn't an obvious one, and it didn't work all that well either.
Off the pitch, you've mentioned Peter Robinson. You were great friends with David Moores. Of course, you had a massive influence on the football club.
Yes, David and I have been friends for many, many years. We don't see quite so much of him these days.
Right.
But, excuse me. Yes, I mean, he just breathes Liverpool. We don't see much of him at games anymore, but he's had a couple of problems and ill health and things like that. But, absolute died-in-the-wool Liverpoolian. They'd die for the club.
Wish him the best. If you had to pick out a game then, and obviously you've been through so many decades with the club, which game would you single out as the most relevant or inspiring, or one that really has all the memories flooding back to you, Terry?
Well, there were so many, but obviously, I think you could ask every Liverpool fan that there'd only be one, and that was that cup final in
Istanbul.
Istanbul.
That supersedes 77, 78, 81, 84.
All of them rolled up. I mean,
really?
I was at every one of the five that we won, and a couple that we lost. But there was nothing like that. I mean, we were three down at half-time. Fans were coming out, going home. We were all up to absolute eyebrows in devastation. And then Stevie Gerrard seemed to just take control. And off he went. That was certainly his finest game ever. And there were many, many of those over the years. But, that night will stay with all of us. People that were there, people that weren't there, people that were watching on television, listening to radio. It absolutely memorable. Nothing else. No sporting occasion, never mind just a football match, will ever compare with that for me.
That's the one. Right, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Just talk about the changing face of Liverpool. You've been, and I said at the start, you probably wouldn't have missed it, you've been incredibly influential on a variety of different levels in this city. Where do you feel it's at the moment?
I feel... Well, we've got a great manager, and I think the squad is as strong as it's ever been. Perhaps one or two weaknesses here and there. Not weaknesses, but areas that can be improved, and I'm sure they will. The manager has been incredibly successful. I mean, the fans love him. Well, that's him, because he's as bad as they are, really. And
he's the closest to Bill Shankly, isn't he, that you've seen?
Yes, he is. His personality, very different. I mean, you'd never see Bill running up and down a touchline. But players used to say that, you know, a look from Shankly was enough. And one or two of them used to say they could always see it from the other side of the pitch. But he's a great manager. I hope he stays at Liverpool a very, very long time. Inevitably, other clubs will start thinking about it, especially on the continent. But he seems to be very happy here. He's done a fabulous job. Here we go. Possibly the most exciting season we've had in many years to come.
Fingers crossed. And you're back up the Radio City Tower. Of course, this is your love, isn't it? And recently the station was awarded the Freedom of the City of Liverpool, which I know was a very proud moment for you.
Yes, it was. It was perhaps 42 years too late, but it was nice to receive it. It was a recognition of from the City Council. And we've always had run-ins from my early days with the City Council, because in many ways they thought they were immune from criticism, but we taught them otherwise very quickly. And to get it was fabulous. It was a wonderful day, evening, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Something else I will always remember.
Do you still look upon the station with a high degree of pride? Is it still your baby, if you like?
Yes. I mean, it's still my baby. It's
changed
grown up,
massively, but...
It's grown up not altogether in the way it would have been if I had still been here. But that's life. Nothing else has remained the same either.
Terry, you've been a wonderful influence on the radio station, the city, and many people as well. Thank you very much indeed for your company. Match of My Life guest today, Terry Smith. You'll be able to watch that full video on our social media.